Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff. For the next hour, we're going to talk about how to be a powerful patient. Have you ever sat for 10 minutes or more in the doctor's examining room in a flimsy little paper robe, feeling colder by the minute? It's moments like that that make us feel powerless. We're going to spend some time together talking about how to regain some of that power and become an equal member of your own healthcare team. This program is brought to you as a service of the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us at thepowerfulpatient.org. Everyone who registers on our website will receive a free copy of our publication, 8 Ways You Can Help Your Doctor Save Your Life. We will answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a special gift. Again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. So what is it that makes us feel powerless, and what can we do about this? I think the crux of it really comes down to communication. The first thing is we need to communicate better with our doctors, and they need to listen to us, and we need to listen to them. And it's that two-way street that needs to happen better. It's not something that you can legislate. It's not something that you can improve overnight. But it is something that I think we can work on. And that's what we're going to work on here at The Powerful Patient. Many of us were brought up to believe that doctors are some kind of superhuman beings, that they have special powers to make us better. And we feel like if we just walk into the doctor's office, that the doctor should be able to wave a magic wand or hand us a pill and make things all better. It's not really like that. There's a communication that needs to happen in order for the doctor to truly understand what the problem is, to identify it and give it a name, and then to be able to work with you to take action against the problem. And the patient has to listen. The patient has to be willing to change, has to be willing to make changes in the way they eat or function, exercise, etc., and also needs to give feedback to the doctor so that over time we will show progress on this problem. It's a partnership with your healthcare providers, or it should be. But many of us don't feel like we're even a member of the healthcare team. It's going to take some work on your own part to try to enroll your healthcare professionals into a true team whose purpose is to maintain your health. But there is a communication that must occur between the two of you before you're going to be able to get to a diagnosis. And a diagnosis is the first step in getting well. If you ever watch any of the medical shows on television, you know the diagnosis is not easy. And sometimes the doctor and the patient go through a number of possible diagnoses before they get to the real one. There's a process that goes on in there called differential diagnosis. In other words, if you get it down to, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, maybe it's something else. Let's say there are three possibilities. How are we going to get from three to one? And one of them is by observation, by looking at the symptoms and looking at the way you respond when, let's say, the little rubber hammer hits your knee. What's the response? So the doctor's looking for signs like that. The doctor will be measuring different things in your blood and so forth, so getting back some information. But in addition to that, it's going to be doing some scans, doing some tests, and trying to determine, well, if this level is within that range, then that rules out number one. So let's see, could it be number two or number three? How are we going to determine that? And the doctor will lay out a set of tests that will help differentiate between option B and option C. There are a number of tools that are available to the doctor these days. Not all of them, however, are available to every patient. And why is that? Well, the health payers, the insurance companies or the HMOs or things like that, sometimes have rules that the doctors need to pay attention to, where they will pay for this test but not that test, or this scan but not that scan, or only a certain number of scans in a year's time. And so the doctor's going to try to work within those. But you and your doctor need also to realize that there are times when we might ask the insurance payer to go beyond those guidelines. Those guidelines are there for good reasons. They're trying to avoid abuse in the system. And you don't want to abuse the system. You don't want more tests than you really need. But on the other hand, if those rules are beginning to constrain you from getting a diagnosis, if they're really getting in the way of your doctor and in the way of your health, then maybe you and your doctor need to speak with the insurance company and ask them to go beyond those parameters. We're going to talk with a number of very interesting people as we go through the weeks with this show. And you'll hear real stories from real people, people who have met amazing challenges and have done very well with them. What I want you to focus on is the interaction between the patient and the doctor, the patient and the medical system. What went well, what didn't go so well, and what could have been changed to make things go better. And hopefully you're going to hear some interesting ideas for ways that you can interact with your healthcare system in a more constructive way. One of the first people that you're going to meet is me. I thought that one of the interesting ways to introduce myself is not just for me to ramble on, but to speak with a friend about my own, what I call my training process. Without signing up for it consciously, I've been essentially in a training program for over 40 years, dealing with healthcare issues for myself, for my husband, for my son, and now in the last 15 years for a wide range of people with a disease called von Hippel-Lindau disease. I'll speak often of VHL, and it's not really necessary for you to know the details, but just to give you a framework. It's one tiny little misspelling in one gene in the body. And because of that misspelling, there's one protein that doesn't quite do its job correctly. And its job is to suppress tumors. So that means that people with VHL are at a greater risk for certain kinds of tumors in different parts of the body, specifically tumors of the retina, brain, spinal cord, kidney, pancreas, and adrenal glands. As one of my friends says, only the important bits. It's a very challenging disease. It's a series of tumors your whole life, and it means learning to cope with a constant battle with keeping your health, finding the right balance point between surgery and health, between worry and not worrying, and so managing your emotions and your relationships with the medical profession, and trying to keep your balance and have a happy life in the middle. As we say, remember to live between tumors. Don't just wait for the next one to fall out of the sky, but have a good time in between. And when you need to worry about your disease, take it down off the shelf, do what you need to do, and then put it back up on the shelf again. But just remember to pay attention to it on a regular basis from time to time. It's like doing maintenance on your house. You can get away with doing no maintenance for a while, but then if you ignore it for too long, you'll have a bunch of things that need to be taken care of all at once. And that's not fun. It's expensive. In your house, it's also potentially very painful if it's your body. What I want to do right now is take a little break and introduce to you Keith Richards, who is a hip-hop artist from New York. Keith has VHL. In another program, we will speak in depth with Keith and with his mother. But for today, let's listen to Keith's song. It's a song called Staples. You know, like the staples you get when you have a surgery? This song is called Staples, remembering his brain surgery. Let's have Keith Richards.
Yeah. What up, what up? Yo, check this out, y'all. Basically, with this track, what I wanted to do is just share a piece of my experience with y'all. You know, something that I went through. Real story, real talk. So, just walk with it, brother. Just walk with me and listen, alright? Peep it, visualize, yo. July 13th, 1998, celebrating my birthday, but still I didn't feel so great. My equilibrium was off and I was mad tired, head hurting, feeling out of it and uninspired. At first I didn't pay it any mind, cause everybody gets a little headache from time to time. So I figured I'd shake it off and keep it moving, but as time went on, I noticed my situation wasn't improving. On my face I kept a frown, because it got to the point where I couldn't keep any food down. Sometimes I would lose the feeling in my hands, couldn't keep it together for nothing, so I had to cancel my plans. On the surface I was cool, taking it in stride, but all the while on the inside I was petrified. My parents could no longer presume, that's when my dad said, get in the car, we're going to the emergency room. Thanks, Dad. So you know, now I'm sitting in the back of my car thinking to myself, yo, I'm thinking somebody done put a root on me or something. I never felt this way in my life. My head is spinning, I'm like on balance. It's crazy, I never felt this way in my life. But yo, keep listening cause it gets deeper. Check it. Yo. So now I'm praying God will keep me from harm. Laid up in a hospital bed with an IV in my arm. I can't begin to explain my aggravation. Surrounded by doctors, but no one can give me an explanation as to what was going on up in my body. I'm constantly hearing words like maybe, possibly, and probably. The doctors were ready to tell me goodbye. That's when my mama said, not until he gets an MRI. That's when the doctor saw it. A hemangioblastoma on my brain, fixing it, put me in a permanent coma. I just cried, thinking I was in the last of my days. I had a grandfather and uncle who passed away from the same exact thing, so I never got to meet him. And now I'm thinking it won't be long before I greet him. Never doubting the word of a physician, but if I gotta choose, I'll always go with mother's intuition. You know? So yeah, so, you know, so basically the doctors were ready to release me and deal with me on an outpatient basis because they really couldn't find anything. My mom was like, oh no you won't, I'm having headaches and they never think to look at my head. How real is that? I guess that's why they call it practicing medicine, huh? But yo. So as soon as my parents knew the deal, they got on the wire. Had the word spreading like wildfire. I'm talking about from Virginia to Delaware, New York to St. Croix. People sending their prayers that God will smile on their baby boy. Basically, it wasn't my decision to make. I couldn't die, simple as that. Make no mistake, I had my whole life ahead of me, and I'd be remiss if I wasn't around for mom, my dad, and my little sis. My procedure went according to plan, so people don't make it through surgery, but here I stand, and I can't complain, life's been good to me thus far, and I keep a fresh cut around my surgical scar. I went back to school, finished it, and got my degree, all on the strength of the fact that my people prayed for me. You were there to hold me down through all the pain and the strife. That makes twice that I owe you my life. Mom, I love you. Yo, that's my word, man. I don't ever want to hear anybody say what God can't do, because I'm here to tell you, I'm a witness, he can do anything. That's my word, man. Good place to be in, you know? I'm here for a purpose, that's my word. Word up. Jay Rawls, what up? Good looking out, yo. Alright? Peace, y'all.
That was Keith Richards thanking his parents and especially his mother for persisting to get him a diagnosis and to get him the appropriate treatment in time. And he's fully recovered now from his brain tumor.
Well, in order to introduce me, I've asked my dear friend to come and interview me. Hi, this is Damon.
Hello. Right. Well, I thought, you know, maybe as an introduction, we could try to talk about your experiences and, you know, in some of the healthcare crises that you've gone through, and you're dealing with different doctors and so forth. And
okay.
I guess really it all starts way back in, you know, the 60s, 70s with your experience with your late husband.
Yes. I got married at 19 in 1963, and he had one blue eye and one gray eye, which I found very endearing. Later I found out that was because the gray eye was actually a dying eye. He had lost vision in it when he was 15. And that was the first thing that I knew about von Hippel-Lindau disease, is that it caused tumors of the retina. But that was under control. He was going regularly for treatments with it, and we knew that it had affected his father, so there was this genetic aspect to it. But that was about all we knew. And a year after we were married, he began having splitting headaches. And they became more frequent, more and more frequent. And then he started throwing up. And we went to the clinic at the college where we were going. And they said, oh, it's the flu. Why don't you go home, take Emperin compound and drink lots of fluids and let me know if it's not better in 3 days. Well, 2 days later, he wasn't keeping anything down. He wasn't even keeping water down. And so I called the campus clinic again, and the doctor said, oh, yeah, it's a really nasty flu, but he should be better in another 2 or 3 days. Well, I was getting scared. I mean, when you don't keep your fluids down, there's a danger of dehydration. So I called the eye doctor at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York. And I said to him, you know, I know this isn't your department, but I'm scared and I don't know what to do. And I told him what was going on. He said, well, I'll tell you what you're going to do. You're going to pack a bag, you're going to put your husband in the car, and you're going to drive to New York now. So we did that. And 5 hours later, we were in the hospital, and they did every test in the books. And the next day they operated and took out a cyst the size of a large potato from his head. Now, if you took a large potato and put it inside your skull, what kind of symptoms do you think you'd get? You know, just about everything. And fortunately, they got it out in time, but he almost died that night. So that was my first experience with a doctor who was insisting on the sort of ordinary, common things that he saw all the time. At a university campus clinic, he saw more flu than anything else, or hypochondria trying to get out of your exams, I suppose. Right. But it didn't occur to him to say a brain tumor. And if I hadn't called that doctor that day, he probably wouldn't have survived. So it's really important to just not stop with the first diagnosis that you're given. If it doesn't make sense to you, ask somebody else. Get another opinion. It's up to you to take the initiative and politely disagree with your doctor.
Right. And I mean, I guess then you had this diagnosis, but nobody understood what that was all about.
Right. There was still no big picture description of what this might imply. So now we knew it could be in the retina, we knew it could be in the brain. His father had some walking difficulty was all we knew. So maybe there was something in the back. But it was one big fog, and there was certainly no information for patients, and there really wasn't very much for doctors. There were case studies, but the doctors also were working in the dark. And also, don't forget, in the 60s, there were no CTs, there were no MRIs. There was no way to see this coming.
Right, so even the sort of diagnostic suite you were talking about doing, I mean, they still, when they went in for the brain surgery, they're doing it on the assumption that given the symptoms were, there's probably something in there. They didn't really know what they were going to find.
Exactly. They were going in without a roadmap, and that's really amazing. Someone told me the other day that what we know about the brain has doubled in the last 10 years. So in the 1960s, that was pretty much the dark ages for neurosurgery, even in the 20th century. So we've come a long way. They know today much better treatments and much better diagnostics than they had then. But the trick is to do them. And if you have a doctor who's telling you that it's the flu and not doing the scan, he doesn't know any more than we knew in 1964.
Now, today it's not just the doctors that you get that you're up against, it's the insurance companies. So
correct.
A lot of the
time. That's right. The insurance companies will say, no, we can't do that CT until there are symptoms. And I heard someone just the other day say that the insurance company refused to do the CT because they didn't feel there were symptoms, even though the patient had splitting headaches, had actually gone into a coma, and was throwing up when she was awake, and they didn't feel that that was enough symptoms to warrant doing a CT.
On top of a family history? And
no, they didn't have a, that one didn't have a family history. This one does. But yeah, all those things count, and sometimes the, in that case, the mother went to the administrator of the hospital and got the CT ordered.
Certainly wasn't the last time you had different diagnoses that you had to work with the doctors to determine what to do.
That's right. We often had differing opinions as to how to approach it. I guess the next most dramatic episode was he had 5 rounds of brain surgery, 5 rounds of spinal surgery, and after the 5th spinal surgery, we were in the hospital, and this young urologist came up and said, we checked his kidneys, and he has multiple cancer tumors on both kidneys, so we need to operate on the 2 kidneys. And we said, whoa, wait a minute, what do you mean kidneys? I mean, this VHL doesn't occur in the kidneys. He said, oh yeah, it does. This was the first time that anybody had ever said kidneys to us. So we didn't even know to look there. And then all of a sudden they say he's got cancer. And he said, I mean, these are cancer tumors, but we can cure him. He needs to have these 2 surgeries. And he kept saying, we can cure him. About the 4th time he said that to me, I turned to him and I said, I hope you know that the word cure has no meaning for us anymore. I'm sure that if this were any other human being just walking down the street with no other medical problems, that you could cure this. But look at this whole human being. At that point, he was blind, half deaf, paraplegic, and still very weak from this major spinal surgery that he'd just been through. And I said, he doesn't need any more surgery right now. So we actually set up a summit conference with the neurologist, the neurosurgeon, this young urologist. I often call him the cowboy urologist. You know, he was young and full of his own power, and really was feeling that he could cure it. So I know he was sincere, but nonetheless, he was pushing us in a way that we weren't ready to go at that point. And I was there, and Frank was there. And the neurologist said, leave the poor man alone. And the neurosurgeon said, leave the poor man alone. And the urologist said, we can cure him. Now, Frank was at heart a marathon runner. And before his 4th spinal surgery, he was running 15 miles a day with a friend in hopes of running the Boston Marathon. That was his dream. So with the spirit of a marathon runner, he thought, if there's any chance of a cure, I have to make this try. So he signed up for 2 kidney surgeries, and 2 kidney surgeries are entirely non-trivial. So they were very hard to get over, and they depreciated his strength, his stamina, his quality of life. And within 2 years, he died of a systemic infection that was a repercussion from those surgeries. So it wasn't that he didn't need the surgeries. It was that it was too much for him at that point. And I think there is a time to say we really need to evaluate this plan of action and maybe not sign up so fast.
So how would you advise people now who were in a similar situation to evaluate these kinds of things?
I think you need to assemble a team. Again, one person can't make the decision like this by themselves. Assemble a team, and the team should include close family members, as well as the various doctors in your medical environment, and really look at all facets of it and say, am I ready now for this surgery or this kind of surgery? I mean, today we have other options. Today we could do it laparoscopically, which wouldn't have as big an impact on someone's stamina as those kidney surgeries, those open kidney surgeries did. So there might be a different way to do it. There might be a different approach. Maybe there's a drug. Maybe there's some other way to handle it. But really look at all of those factors. And if it's possible to postpone a surgery, maybe just a little more time is what you need. Because, you know, like a tennis player doesn't go back on the circuit immediately after she has a baby. You need a little time for your body to recoup its forces and gather its stamina again. And I think that's a reasonable analogy for when someone says, oh, you need the third surgery this year. Do you really need that third surgery this year, or could we postpone it till next spring? And those are all pertinent questions.
Well, I think, too, you know, rather than take every doctor's word as gospel, you, especially in this age of specialists, you can anticipate that, you know, the neurosurgeon is going to recommend neurosurgery and the kidney surgeon is going to recommend kidney surgery, and taking their advice is important, but you also need to understand their perspective and try to integrate that into a more holistic view of the yourself as patient. Or
right. I have another story that illustrates that. As a matter of fact, in 1979, I had breast cancer, and I found a lump. And I went to my GP and tearfully told him about my lump. And he said to me, oh, honey, bad things like that don't happen to pretty young girls like you. I was 34. Well, I knew that that was the wrong answer, but I knew that I wasn't going to get very far arguing with him, so I didn't say any more. And within the week, I went to my gynecologist and told him the same story. And he said, well, we're not going to panic, but we do need to check this out. So we're going to take it one step at a time and just make sure that it's okay. So I went to a surgeon. We did a lumpectomy, and it was positive. It was cancer. And the surgeon sat me down, and he explained to me that he thought I should have a modified radical mastectomy. But, he said, I have to tell you, I'm a surgeon. And I look at the world through a surgeon's glasses. So, of course, I think surgery is the right answer. But if I were you, I would want to check into my other options. And he handed me a piece of paper with the name and telephone number of a radiation oncologist to talk about radiation and someone to talk with about chemotherapy. And he said, I want you to go do your homework. We'll make an appointment for 2 weeks from now. We'll come back and we'll talk again. So I went and did my homework, and I came back in 2 weeks, and I signed up for the modified radical mastectomy. But what I learned from the wisdom of that exchange was that it was extremely important to me for my long-term health to do that homework, to take the time to find out what my options were. How can you choose option A when you don't know what B and C are? And in fact, it was critically important. I didn't even realize at the time, because for the last 30 years, I've been able to read the women's magazines about keep your breasts, don't let them take it off, and know that I made the right decision. I made the right decision not because it was the right one for everyone, but that it was the right one for who I was at that point in time. And I'm content with that decision. And here I am 30 years later talking about it, so I guess it was okay.
How does one take all that information then? I mean, let's say you go to doctors A, B, and C, and they all say, oh, we have a treatment for you. And each of them seems pretty confident in their treatment and the outcome. I mean, how do you know who to trust in those situations?
Right. But that's only one factor. Actually, the factor that played the loudest for me in 1979 was that here I was a young widow with a six-year-old at home, and the only way I could get a definitive answer was with the surgery. The chemotherapy was going to say, we think we got it all, and the radiation was going to say, we think we got it all, but the surgery could give me a pathology report that said, yep, clean margins, lymph nodes okay, you're in good shape. And I needed that. And I also needed not to wear myself down in front of my six-year-old and make him worry that he was going to lose me, too.
The one thing that I wonder about as we talk about these things from, you know, 20-plus years ago is trying to draw some kind of a line so that people going through some of this stuff, you know, can understand the, you know, the real difference between then and now. You know, if somebody with breast cancer is listening, mm-hmm. you know, they hear it as being about their disease. And I just feel like there's a difference, you know, that the time difference makes a lot of difference. Yeah. You know, is there a way
to... The choices are different today. I think that,
right. I mean, yeah, to speak to that somehow.
And the repercussions of the treatment are probably not as severe today as...
Right. Or they might, you know, maybe in, you know, maybe some of these things... In the 70s, they were much less secure about, you know, that, like, that, well, we feel like we could, you know, with the 75% certainty get it, whereas now they'd be like, well, with like a 99% or whatever, right. you know, whatever it might be.
Yes, that's true.
Just to make it clear, maybe, that there was more uncertainty with it then, or more...
Right, and I think whatever you're facing, you need to look at what are the options today and what are the options that are relevant for me. And those are always going to keep shifting because we're learning more all the time.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a little break here. Don't go away. We'll be right back. This program is brought to you as a service of the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us at thepowerfulpatient.org. Everyone who registers on our website will receive a free copy of our publication, 8 Ways You Can Help Your Doctor Save Your Life. We will answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a special gift. Again, the website is powerfulpatient.org.
So then the next set of trials came some years later with you, and as your son was diagnosed with VHL.
Right.
Could you tell us some about that?
Yes, it was 9 years after my husband passed away that my son decided he wanted contact lenses. He was 15 and didn't want to wear his glasses. The vanity was setting in, which is a healthy thing. So I agreed we should send him for contact lenses. And I had taken him, since he was 3, to an ophthalmologist every year to keep an eye out on his retinas and make sure that he was okay, because we knew there was about a 50-50 chance that he could have gotten the family gene here. And I wanted to make sure that if he was going to have a problem, that we found it early. But the doctor kept saying to me, oh no, he doesn't have it. I would have seen it by now. So sort of patted me on the head. You can stop worrying now, mother. It's all right. So when he started asking about contact lenses, I went to the regular ophthalmologist and asked if he would check him. And he said he was on the verge of retirement and had stopped doing contacts. So he gave me the name of another practice in town. And I went down and made the appointment there and filled out the medical history record and put on that record, as I always did, that there was VHL in the family. So he went in for his test and came home with a note that said that he should see a retinal specialist. And my heart just went through the floor. I was stunned. And here the doctor had just told me to quit worrying. And here was a signal that he might have a problem on his retinas. So I was just shattered. And I think the first thing I went through was anger. I look back now and realize I was in a sort of grieving process. And the first step in grieving is anger. So I got mad at both the doctors, at the first one for telling me to quit worrying, and at the second one for suggesting, how could he possibly suggest that there was a problem in the retinas when this other doctor had told me there was not. So I gave them each other's telephone numbers and said, you guys work this out. And if you think I need to go to the retinal specialist, I will. But I'm really angry about this. So they did call me back and said that they thought that we should go see the retinal specialist, which we did, and he diagnosed VHL. So that was the beginning of my second journey with this complex medical condition. And I'd been out of it now for 9 years. So at the end of that doctor's appointment, the doctor said to me, well, I'll see you again in 2 years. And I said, that seems like a long time, because teenage years are a time when a lot can happen in the retina. He said, oh, that's true. So let's make it 1 year. And he wasn't saying anything else. And I said, well, from what I know about VHL, it can occur in more than just the retinas. So is there some other testing we ought to be doing here? Any kind of non-invasive testing that we could do, I think we ought to do, because I'd like to make sure I know what ballgame we're playing. So he agreed, and he gave us the name of a neurologist that we went down to visit. And he passed all the neurology tests, and they played ball and touched his nose and did the standard neurology tests you do with children. And we went home and thought that things were okay. And 2 weeks later, I get a call from the neurologist, and he said, you know, I've been reading up on this VHL stuff, and one other place it can occur that we probably should check is the kidneys. So we scheduled an ultrasound for the kidneys. And my 15-year-old was adamant that he didn't want me to go along, so he took his friend and went down and did the ultrasound. And within a day or two, I get a call at my office. And it was a resident whose name I still don't know. And the resident said, we found something and we need you to come in and talk with the doctor. Well, you can imagine how I reacted. My heart sort of froze up, and I said, oh, what did you find? And he said, oh, the doctor will tell you when you come in. I said, no, I don't think I'll live that long. I think you need to tell me now. So he took a deep breath, and he said, well, now, I don't want you to worry about this, because we have this down to a science. You know, it's really not a problem these days. But we did find multiple tumors on both kidneys, and we'll just take out both his kidneys and wait for a transplant. And I said, that may not sound like a problem to you, but that sounds like a problem to me. Are you telling me you want to take my asymptomatic 15-year-old boy and put him on dialysis? I don't think so. So that was the introduction to what became a very harried month ahead for me. I went over to my boss and I said, something's going on with my son. I don't know what it is, but I think I need to go be a patient advocate for a while. And frankly, I have no idea how long this is going to take. So, bless her heart, she said to me, do what you have to do, just stay in touch. And I've always remembered the support that I got from my work. And I have to tell you, it engendered a tremendous loyalty in me to that outfit. And I stayed with them for 15 years, partly because of that moment. So I did. I went off, and it was 2 weeks before I went back to work. And one of the things I did was I went to the Harvard Medical School Library, because I'm in Boston, right? So you go to the source, and I said, I've been out of this for 9 years. I need to know what they've learned about VHL in the meanwhile. So I'm going through all these dusty old volumes, some of which are in German, and I'm going through the articles about von Hippel-Lindau. And at a certain point, I said to myself, you know what? I'm doing what a doctor would have to do to find out about VHL. I'm going through the doctor's sources here, and this is really hard. And the reality is that the doctor doesn't have the time to do this.
Yeah, you had 2 weeks off.
I took 2 weeks off to do it. But no, seriously, it was really hard work. And this was 1986. So that was the beginning of the notion that has blossomed for me into the fact that people with rare disorders really have to band together and take some responsibility for helping their doctors get up to speed really fast. Because doctors get second chances. Patients don't always get second chances. So we need to make sure that the doctor and the patient are going to have a good experience on the first go. And that we now have a handbook, but it took a long time to develop it. Anyway, back to 1986. And so I learned as much as I could about it. And I wanted to find out about VHL in the kidney. And I looked for articles about people with kidney aspects. And I found one article that was about 10 years old. And I thought, oh, good, maybe he has some follow-up on those patients. So I called that author, and he was retired. So then I called the second author, who was a genetic counselor in Kansas. And she said, take out his kidneys? We almost never take out kidneys. Oh, thank you. I said, you can imagine, hope bloomed, you know. So that was the beginning of my pushing back on the doctors in Boston and really saying, prove it, that they need to come out, or isn't there a better way?
The things that are occurring to me have mostly to do with the, you know, the importance of sort of self-education, you know, educating yourself, educating your doctors, and the sort of specialization, you know, seems to be in like an increasing barrier to proper diagnosis. It seems like a neurologist often wouldn't even think to look at that, or if they did, they'd assume that you were already on top of that, that their, you know, their piece of the puzzle is.
Yeah. We ran into that a lot. We formed this organization in 1993, and one of the things we found in the beginning was that ophthalmologists were pretty well up on von Hippel-Lindau. They usually would diagnose it. So if you were lucky enough to get to a good ophthalmologist early on, the ophthalmologist would catch it and take good care of it. But the ophthalmologists were usually not referring you to a neurologist or a urologist. They weren't telling you about the brain or kidney aspects. And one of the things that we discovered was that in many cases, it was because they themselves, as a human being, didn't want to have that uncomfortable conversation with their patient. Because you can imagine, the patient would go through shock, grief, maybe anger, a lot of human emotions that many doctors just really didn't want to confront. So there is a human aspect to this too. You're right, it's specialization, and add into that this human self-protection thing about, oh, I don't want to face that conversation today. But you're not, they're not doing the patient any favors by withholding that information. So one way or another, the patient needs to know that. And if this doctor's not up for it, maybe he can delegate that to a nurse or a genetic counselor or somebody, but the patient needs to know. And these days, of course, you don't have to go down to a medical school library and go through the dusty stacks. You can go to the internet and find out more than you ever wanted to know about some conditions. Much of it true and much of it untrue. So there's a sifting out process you also need to go through.
Right. It also seems that a lot of times now specialists might hesitate to refer you to another specialist, as medical teams are, at least in theory, set up around a primary care physician, and the specialists never talk to each other. There's, you know, the primary doctor at the hub of the wheel, and then everybody else is out on doing their own thing.
They can suggest it, and they don't always suggest it, you're right. But the primary care doctor, of course, doesn't know everything there is to know about every rare disease either. There are thousands of rare diseases. No one person can be expected to know about all the rare diseases there are. But there are resources for doctors as well as for patients, and hopefully that team, the doctor and the patient together, can discover the information necessary and will make the referrals. As long as the insurance company doesn't bung up the works.
So now all of these experiences you've had with different doctors and diagnoses and treatment options and things, how have they come together in terms of creating this, you know, philosophy of the powerful patient?
I think primarily what I've learned is that unless the patient really grabs hold, or someone close to the patient, sometimes it's not the individual who's affected. Maybe it's a parent, maybe it's a spouse, but and sometimes it's a friend. But someone has to really take charge of keeping your own documentation together. Maybe you keep copies of the scans and the radiology reports, so that you have a pile that's under your control that you can carry with you to the next specialist, and you keep a list of who you've seen and haven't seen, and really take responsibility, really manage this team. And more, it feels to me almost like owning a professional ball team. You know, like you play fantasy baseball and stuff, right?
Don't know how that's relevant, but...
Well, but but you don't have to know how to pitch, but you do have to know how to get the best pitcher on your team. And then how to manage all of these specialists, if you will, some of whom may be sort of prima donnas, right? But you have to get these guys to work together as a team. And the objective is to win the game. And in this case, winning the game is staying healthy for your whole life. It's not just about fixing this one tumor. It's about being well for your whole life. And that's the perspective that medicine in the United States does not always take. The perspective of the insurance company is what's best for the bottom line this year. The perspective of the doctor usually is how do we fix this tumor? But the perspective of the patient should be how do I stay well and happy for my whole life?
So how does one assemble such a team? I would think that often they're just dealt doctors that they have and feel that they don't have much say in the matter.
Right, and there's been plenty of times I've felt that myself. But what I've learned is, especially if you have a rare condition, you really have to go looking for someone who's knowledgeable about your condition, somebody who's done it before. I have a friend who was telling me her story about a kind of surgery on a rare tumor the other day. And there was a doctor who says, great, we're going to operate on Thursday. And she said, wait a minute, how many of these have you ever done? And he said, personally? And she said, yes. And he said, well, none, but I love the opportunity. Now, it's very nice that he would love the opportunity, but is that really going to be the best for this patient? So sometimes we're better consumers of car repair services or roofing services than we are of healthcare services. If somebody said to you, oh, your roof needs to be fixed and it'll cost $30,000, sign here. Are you going to sign that document? Or are you going to get a second opinion?
Well, it's also easier for them to show you another roof in the neighborhood that they've worked on than
right.
You know, in the medical world.
That's right, because of the confidentiality stuff. The confidentiality is there to protect us in one sense, but in another sense, it mitigates against connecting us with other people who are fellow travelers.
Is there a difference between shopping around for doctors that you feel you have a philosophical connection with in terms of their treatment plans and looking for someone who will agree with your own diagnosis? Or, you know, is there a risk involved there of only hearing what you want to hear because you, if you shop around till you find what you are looking for?
Yes. I mean, one of the things that tends to happen these days is someone will go out on the internet with the set of symptoms that they're experiencing and say, ah, I must have blah-bitty-blah disease. So they'll find one on the internet that seems to fit and go in and tell the doctor that they have this disease. That's a very dangerous thing to do because you may or may not be right. And if you go in and tell the doctor, sometimes he'll get his back up and say, wait a minute. Don't tell me what you have, I'll tell you what you have. And now all of a sudden you have this contentious relationship. You do not want a contentious relationship with your medical people. You want a teamwork relationship with your medical people. So if you went in and said, I've been looking on the internet, here are my symptoms, and these are some of the things that I found that might be it. What do you think? Is there a way that we could rule some of these in or out? Now that's more of an enrolling kind of thing. And you might be able to get the doctor to say, well, it can't be this because I did this test last week, and if it were that, then this level would be higher. You can have a productive discussion about it. You got to give room for your hypothesis to be wrong because you didn't go to medical school, and you don't have the tests in front of you, and you cannot diagnose yourself on the internet. You can get some good suggestions. So I'm not discouraging you from doing it, but just be very careful about the way you approach the doctor with it.
Does that apply as well to treatment options as far as you had mentioned earlier about, you know, Dr. A suggesting taking out kidneys and hunting around, it sounds like through great effort, to find Dr. B, who suggested not doing that.
Right.
You know, to what lengths should one go to find that, you know, that dissenting opinion?
I think I've always admired Dr. Bangalow for saying to me, I'm a surgeon and I look at the world through a surgeon's glasses, because that is so admirable, to acknowledge that about oneself and to help the patient go through that process. I've always been very grateful to him for doing that. And I hear stories of somebody saying, well, I know you're a fine surgeon, but I've heard about this chemotherapy treatment, and the surgeon might get really huffy and very offended that you're thinking of disagreeing with his opinion. That's his problem. That's not your problem. And, you know, if somebody gets huffy with you like that, maybe he's not the right doctor. So don't necessarily throw him away, because you don't hire a doctor for his personality. You hire a doctor for his skill. So be careful of hiring people based on personality. But at the same time, remember that this choice is yours. It's your body, and you're the one who's going to have to live with the consequences for the rest of your life. And so you're not there to please the doctor. You're there to achieve your health.
And I guess there's often not just one correct answer. You know, it isn't math.
That's right.
You know, there are several answers that may be effective to varying degrees or may be similarly effective, and it's just a matter of approach and philosophy.
That's right. Sometimes it's approach and philosophy. Sometimes it's, these are all three valid choices. Which one of them fits your lifestyle, your beliefs, your desires better than another? Don't know. But there are many, many factors that are going to go into this equation. Only part of them are the technical ones.
Well, you know, the thing that is interesting for me, and I guess it would be, you know, a different conversation in a way. But, like, you know, I've gotten rid of doctors for varying reasons. And a lot of them, it seems, a number of them anyway, have been personality-based. But, you know, one of the things I think that has really bugged me overall that has cost a couple of doctors my business, not that they really care, is that they don't want to listen to me, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not saying I'm like, you know, obviously I'm not trained as a doctor and stuff, but, you know, I know certain things, like, you know, when I was on dialysis, I would see a certain kidney doctor and I'd have symptoms that I know are related to something or other, you know, or I have theories. And when I'd go to Martha Pavlakis, I'd often be like, okay, so I've got a theory, you know, and she'd like listen to it and accept parts of it or help to explain other things or something like that. But that, you know, there was this guy that was one of my kidney guys at one point that just, you know, didn't want to hear anything about, you know, any of my theories or something. And I just couldn't wait to dump him. you know, just things like that, that, like, you know, it's sort of a different conversation in a way, because it's like, how do you assemble your team and keep it, like, as you're saying, sort of manage it over time. Another example would be Dr. Toppy, in a way, who is a great guy and very caring and all this, but over time turned out to be kind of like hiding from me the seriousness of one of my things because he didn't want to tell me that there was nothing he could do about it, you know? And so it's like, you know, there, you know, I guess it's dealing with the sort of personalities involved, but it's, you know, there have been a lot of different, I guess, these relationships with doctors that...
Right.
Some...
And you do have to manage your relationship with doctors, because you don't want to make an enemy of this person. if you do feel that he has the right talent, but you realize that he's got a fragile ego or something like that, then maybe you need to stroke his ego now and then. Or, you know, as you said, if the interactions are just not going the way you want, this may not be the right doctor for you. So that is an option. You're the manager. Well, you get to hire and fire.
The experience of a doctor is invaluable to an extent, at least. The skill level is, I think, overdone in that, you know, when you're looking at a surgeon, they're pretty skilled, you know?
Right.
I mean, you know, obviously you don't want the worst surgeon on the staff, but, you know, the difference between the number one surgeon in Boston and the number 10 surgeon in Boston is probably not all that much.
But it might be experience with a particular problem.
Right.
And that adds in and might sway the difference.
But, you know, you get, like, my ego experience with a surgeon is that guy, right, I've even, you know, blocked his name out from my memory, that, you know, thought of himself as, like, the best guy in the business, and I feel may have kind of given up on that kidney because he was like, oh, look at all this, I'll be here for an hour, and that he didn't necessarily have the time or the patience, you know, for himself to be doing this when he could be.
One of the critical factors that I realized when we were going through those difficult times where the doctors seemed to want to take out the kidneys and we really wanted them not to take out the kidneys, yeah, I had to feel comfortable that the doctor was kind of with the program, you know, because if I was asking him to do something that he was philosophically opposed to, it was probably going to go his way. But if I really felt that he was on board with the philosophy, I'll take out what I have to, but no more than I have to, that then I was comfortable with them proceeding. And I haven't always made all the best choices there either, I have to say. But that's the basis on which I've come to make that kind of decision. Is the doctor on the same wavelength with me?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess as far as this, you know, the prime conversation we're having, you know, the danger is, you know, if you're a patient that's new to some disorder, how do you know that this is the philosophy you should be looking for? I mean, it just feels right, or it's what, you know, somebody, I mean, I think it's making that choice that's difficult when, you know, everything does sound like the right way to go. You know, something might sound safer and something else might sound easier, but.
Well, I remember one time that you were looking for a new GP and you told me that one of your criteria was that you wanted to make sure that this person would be willing to have a conversation about alternative and complementary approaches in addition to the traditional Western medicine approaches. Because some doctors will laugh you out of the room when you say natural foods and that kind of thing. But on the other hand, you don't want to go in and say, I'm not going to take any of these stupid drugs. I want only natural foods. If you do that, then you're limiting your choices as well as the doctor's choices. And that's going to be an impossible relationship. But at least to find someone who's open to having the kind of conversations that you feel you need to have in order to reach the right decisions.
Yeah, and maybe the GP is in a lot of ways the key to this all, especially given the way that insurance companies sort of make you set up your healthcare team. But somebody who's on the same page with you as far as how you're going about managing your disorder.
Right. It's not all about specialists. We still need to do the routine stuff because we're still members of the general population. Even if you have some esoteric rare disease, you're still a member of the general population. So you still need to do the regular routine stuff. And I know sometimes I've spoken to people who have specialized conditions and they'll say, oh, the doctor I see almost exclusively is my neurosurgeon. Well, that's fine, but what do you do about the flu? You know, when the regular stuff comes up, you can't call your neurosurgeon. You've got to have a base team as well.
Right.
Thank you. I really appreciate you doing this.
Sure.
Thank you, Damon, and thank you, everyone, for being with us today. Next week, we're going to begin a series of conversations about caregivers and taking care of the caregivers. So please join us, and we'll see you next week on The Powerful Patient.